ready for this. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. I'm Gary Bell along with Brad Pollock. We're here for you to answer your questions on any legal subject. This is a law talk show. 303-713-8255. 303-713-8255. We'll answer your questions, solve your problems. We do it every week. We're glad to do it. Our website, championsofthepeople.com. All of our 6 books are there. You can download a free copy of our books. Or if you want a hard copy, you can call the studio right here, right now. Give us your information. We'll send you a hard copy. Or you can call our law firm at any time. Okay, we've got a new case coming up before the United States Supreme Court. It was argued in November. It deals with the Stored Communication Act. Talks about the retrieval of electronic information. So how many of you think that your phone records are private, or you should have an expectation of privacy with regard to your phone records? How many of you think that you should have an expectation of privacy with your bank records? So this case is called the Carpenter versus the United States. Carpenter was accused of several crimes. He was tracked with the cell phone records by pinging off the towers, and the police went and got the cell phone records without a warrant. And so it's been argued before the United States Supreme Court. He was ultimately convicted. He tried to suppress that evidence. He tried to keep the cell phone records out of evidence because they tracked his location. And he was very close to the multiple robberies and burglaries that were taking place over years. He was given 116 years in prison. And so he appealed, and the United States Supreme Court is deciding this. So, Brad, let's just talk a little bit about the Stored Communication Act. Everybody would naturally think, I would think you need a search warrant to get bank records and cell phone records.
Well, not necessarily. For a private entity, the Stored Communication Act acts as a protection to keep private entities from getting your cell phone information. But as for governmental entities, it gives the governmental entity, if they can present articulable facts to the entity storing the cell phone records, that they are entitled to get the information they need in order to carry out the investigation, then the cell phone company can turn it over. So it turns out being a situation where the government has access to a lot of your cell phone records without having to get warrants and without having to show, amazingly enough, without resulting in a determination that you don't have an expectation of privacy.
Yeah, but the Stored Communications Act was a part of the Electronic Communications Act, and it was passed in 1986, and it was passed because the internet was coming. Here was coming the information superhighway, and because there was arguments that the Fourth Amendment was written at a time when there was no digital world like there is today, and that the Fourth Amendment didn't necessarily cover or protect those items like cell phone records, cell phone information, pinging off towers, bank records. And so it was passed in 1986 to strengthen the Fourth Amendment illegal search and seizure laws, and to strengthen them against getting your information, against getting your bank information, against getting your cell phone records information. And so the United States Supreme Court has 2 precedents to overcome: the United States versus Miller, which said you didn't need a search warrant, and Smith versus Maryland, which said you didn't need a search warrant. So it's a hot topic, and it's going to be decided by the United States Supreme Court. Just recently argued, fascinating arguments, fascinating concept. The Constitution written a long time ago, Fourth Amendment written a long time ago, had no contemplation of these type of events. So right now we're going to talk to Gary from Boulder. Good morning, Gary. What can we do for you?
No, this is Robert.
Robert, what can we do for you?
Yeah, just on your subject, how long are those records kept? And this is like electronic DNA. So
yeah, that's a good point, electronic DNA. And so, you know, but that was the whole purpose of the Electronic Communications Act. And Title II of that act was the Stored Communications Act. And it has all kinds of very detailed definitions of digital data, digital information, and it's very, very technical.
And they do voice patterning on your voice as well?
You know, I haven't seen that's included. Plus, I when I've looked at the Stored Communications Act, I haven't seen that there's anything that requires or directs entities or anybody of the length of time that they have to store the information? That's a good question. Is how long do they hold on to it, and how long do they have to hold on to it?
And what about voice patterning? I mean, they can pick you out of a crowd from the guy that almost sounds like you next door to say, yeah, that's him.
You're exactly right. They can do it easily. You know, but the thing that has been the most right now that they've used it for is not listening to the conversations, which I would think you still have an expectation of privacy if you're listening to what the person's saying, but they've used it for tracking. Where are you and what are you doing and how have you been using the phone and when have you been using the phone, and does it coordinate with the pattern of crimes that they're trying to unwind?
Yeah, that's what that Miles Square building in Utah is all about.
That's right. I mean, you know, it comes up to what's the it maybe the content of your conversation is protected, but the fact that you're having the conversation and where you're having it from is not protected.
And what time?
Yeah. So
I can imagine a lot of cases are developing that way, aren't they, in the law system?
Well, if you stop and look at it, you put those steps together, those things together, can help pinpoint exactly what a person's doing. I mean, we know you're at this place at this time. Using your phone, or we've been able to track your phone. What's interesting, Robert, is it may not even be the use of your phone. The fact that you're carrying it and the different cell towers are picking it up because your phone is on may be a way for the government to track where you are and what you're doing at different, or not what you're doing, but where you are.
Well, that's a given.
And so if they're able to use that, do you believe that when you're walking around with your cell phone in your pocket that you have an expectation of privacy as to where you're at? And it's coming up to the point of where it sounds like the trend is no, you don't. If you decide to keep your phone on and have it with you, you don't have an expectation of privacy.
Or if you punch the button that allows your access to your location. But this is a very powerful case before the United States Supreme Court, because courts deal with precedent. Lawyers can argue in front of courts that, you know, this court decided this issue 20 years ago, 30 years ago. You look at Roe versus Wade. That's a court precedent. It's hard to overcome. In this case, United States versus Miller, incredible case, a precedent that the United States Supreme Court is looking at. United States versus Miller said there was no warrant required, obtaining bank records of a guy running an illegal whiskey distilling operation. There was no violation of the Fourth Amendment because they said he, quote, voluntarily conveyed the information to the banks. Voluntarily conveyed it. That's a precedent. No warrant was required. Whether you agree or not, that's a precedent. And then Smith versus Maryland, even more fascinating, they said there no warrant was required and there was no Fourth Amendment violation. When the phone company installed a device to record all of the phone numbers that a robbery suspect called from his home, using the phone, no Fourth Amendment. So whether you agree or now, whether the United States Supreme Court agrees or doesn't agree, they have two court precedents that they've decided, and Miller was in 76, and Maryland, Smith versus Maryland was in 79.
So Robert, sitting here, would you have thought that your bank records were confidential?
I think that's why the whole thing was constructed, to tell you the truth. I mean, this goes a lot deeper than what seems to be on the face of it. I mean, I think that's the idea of it to begin with.
Well,
who's doing what, where, when, and how?
And sometimes there is that thing that you say, okay, are they saying this is the result we want? Now we're going to work backwards to try and justify it. So, you know, but the question comes up that you keep looking at. Can he hold?
Robert, can you stick with us?
Yes, sir.
Good. Stick with us.
We got a break coming up. You're listening to the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. Any of our books are there. They're free. Our most recent book is The Definitive Guideline on Colorado Car Insurance. You know what to do when you rent a car? You know what the insurance requirements are? Do you know what you should do? Get our book. It's free. It's a no-brainer. You can call the studio right now. We'll send you a copy. And we do this because we are your champions of the people. Good morning. Here we go. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. We're here for you. 303 303- 713-8255, and welcome to all of our mountain communities. You can call us at 970-457-1009. That's 457-1009. This is a Law Talk show. We talk law. Right now we're talking to Robert from Boulder. We never got to your question, Robert. We got all jazzed up on the Electronic Communication Act.
Yes, but what you said is a really good subject. I wish we could talk about that for the entire show. But like in Alice in Wonderland, it becomes curiouser and curiouser. Every answer begs the next question.
In other words, it's a rabbit hole we don't want to go down, right?
No, you do want to. I mean, let's dig into it and find out exactly what's happening.
Listen, I think people believe they have a reasonable expectation of privacy to the bank records. I think they have the same reasonable expectation of privacy to the phone records. But we have two cases that tore that down, and then they passed the Stored Communication Act, and here we go.
Robert, I got to be honest with you. When I'm reading this stuff and I'm looking at it, I feel like I'm watching the NFL on a catch. I don't know for sure what the reasonable expectation of privacy is or isn't, and where my Fourth Amendment rights begin or end.
Well, back to my question. This is a theoretical. I'm beyond that point. But you have 2 months left on your rent. You're renting. And you just decide to have your damage deposit and your first month's rent used for your last 2 months. And the landlady says, which you know pretty well, we can't do that. You have to pay me the rent, and then I have 30 days to pay you. So, okay, so you say, no, just apply the rent and the damage deposit. And she said, we can't do that. So you just don't pay your rent. She takes you to court. And then you say, I know that's what the statute is, but, the Colorado revised statutes, why can't you do that? And then you sue her because she has 30 days to return your rent, and you get double deposit, double damages for not returning the rental deposit and damage deposit, which is just fine. She's agreed with that. So it's kind of a double question. Why can't we just settle this on a simple fashion? She wants to do it legally.
Well, yeah, there is a statute, and usually the lease provides the fact that you can't force the landlord to use the security deposit for the last month's rent. Besides, the landlord has the right to assess the damages, etc.
Well, and by the way, the statutes are 3812102 and 3812 to 3812104. But here's the thing that it starts with. And you got to look at the lease if you sign a lease. And you got to look at the lease to see if you're giving that money as a last month's rent or a security deposit or both.
It was never designed that way.
That's right. And the question is, how are they collecting it? And it's kind of interesting because I still see quite often where landlords are renting the property and they say, I want the first and last month's rent in advance. And then they want to take that last month's rent that they received and use it as security deposit. And if it says in the lease that they're taking the first and last month's rent in advance, now all of a sudden they've got themselves to where that money they're holding is actually rent. Now, I think you can say, I'm going to apply it against the rent, my last month's rent, because that's why you took it. You said it was last month's rent. And you, in essence, if they didn't get more money for the security deposit, they actually don't have a security deposit. Now, if it's the other way around, if they say, I want first month's rent and I want a security deposit of so much dollars for the protection of my property or for to make sure my property is properly taken care of when you leave, then I think you got a different story, because now I don't think you can hold that money. I'm sorry, I don't think as a tenant you can walk in and say, use it as my last month's rent, because they didn't take it for that purpose. So I think a lot of times it begins with between the tenant and landlord being clear on why are you giving this money and what's the use of it.
Well, do you have the ability to sue her after 30 days when she hasn't returned your deposit?
If they haven't returned your deposit, we know the procedure pretty much. You got to give them written notice that you intend to sue them. They've got to give 7 days for them to return the money. If they don't return it within 7 days, you can take them into court. And actually, you can get three times, not two times. You can get three times the amount of damages plus your attorney's fees for suing them.
Has that ever happened? You know?
Oh, yeah. The judges will enforce that. That is, the bottom line is it's incumbent upon the landlord when the tenant moves out, it's incumbent upon the landlord to within 30 days or 60 days, if the lease gives them 60 days, but within that time period to give a written statement of with an itemization of why they're withholding the money and to return any leftover money from what they're being held.
But it's a technical statute. So if the landlord puts in the lease, nothing in the lease, they have to give you an accounting itemized. Brad said the key word, itemized accounting, within 30 days. If they say we in the lease, they say we can extend it to 60 days, that's proper. They can't do it past 60 days. So if they don't comply, then, and you see, you're the tenant, you say, give me my money, you didn't comply. Well, that's a legal demand, but that doesn't meet the terms of the statute to get the three times. You have to give the notice to the landlord, so you have to follow the technical stairway to the top of the mountain.
Right. It's a seven-day notice. You have to tell them, I'm going to sue you because you haven't given me this money. And then the landlord has the opportunity to give the balance of the money or to address that topic. Now, if the landlord's given the list, and it's just wrong, if they're saying, wait a minute, you gave a list and I have pictures and you've got the wrong place, or I really didn't leave it that bad. Now you can have a fight in court as to whether the landlord properly withheld the money. Because the whole idea of the treble damages and the attorney's fees is to get the landlord to give the accounting. It's not to punish the landlord if the landlord believes that you didn't properly take care of my property and you believe you did, because the normal wear and tear topic comes in, and that's a very difficult topic when you start saying, did you leave my place with normal wear and tear?
I got a question for you two legal gurus this morning, Robert and Brad, and all you listeners. Here we go. You put your thinking cap on. Can you enter into an agreement, i.e. a lease, i.e. a contract? Can you have a contract between two private parties that changes a statute? Can you do that? Well, we just have a contract that changes the statute for the security deposit from 30 days to 60 days, so you can do that. Next question, law school. Here we go. Can you have an agreement, contract, lease between two private parties? Let's make one up. So here, I'm going to lease this property out to you, and I'm going to go ahead and agree that you can use this property as a meth lab. No problem. You agree, I agree. We have an agreement between two parties, a contract, a binding contract that changes the statute and violates the statute. What do you think, Robert?
I would hope so. I mean, that's why you have a new statute every now and then.
Right. So, but one's a criminal enterprise and you're engaging in a crime, and that would be a fascinating situation, because did the landlord and tenant say you can use this as a meth lab? Did they just conspire to violate the criminal statute?
Well, I think in most cases when you get that kind of situation that you're talking about, you leave your property subject to being seized.
Well, what if you were in your right mind when you signed the lease? You were drunk or you were under the influence of drugs?
We're talking about competency to enter into a contract and or have the intent to commit a crime. Great question, Robert. Way to go.
Did you have the mental capacity? But, you know, I think if you rent your apartment building out to be a brothel, I think you're subject to having the property seized and having the business closed down.
Well, it's a contract, Brad. It's an enforceable agreement.
But, you know, and the thing is the one you brought up about the 30 days to 60 days is the statute gives you permission to extend to 60, but notice the statute says you cannot go past 60. And I don't think you can violate that. Now, I think a lot of times you have to look at the statute itself that you're trying to contract around to see if you can do that. But most of the time, I don't think you can contract around a statute. I think you're going to find that, and especially if you're contracting around the statute to allow criminal activity on the property, I think you're headed down a road where you're going to suddenly find that property being seized by the government and the operations being closed down. And you can't do that. But
so in certain circumstances, you can enter into a contract agreement. That's perfectly fine if you change a statute, perfectly fine. Obviously, one of the compelling overriding interests is to see if it's a criminal statute or if the public interest is involved. So that's proper. But then, you know, how did we all of a sudden morph from Fourth Amendment and cell phone and pinging on the towers to brothels and meth labs? How do we do that?
you led us astray this morning.
You guys are pushovers.
Yeah. Well, you know, to get back to your rent and deposit question, which is what you called about, the bottom line is that, you know, you can see the purpose behind the statute. You can see the protections they're trying to build in for both. But the main protection is, remember, you have to leave property the way you found it with reasonable wear and tear. And if you're damaging and destroying the property, the landlord has the right to use that money. Unless, Robert, I agree with you that if the landlord says, I'm taking that as last month's rent, then guess what? The landlady better recognize that she just took it as last month's rent. And when it comes out last month, you say, that's my rent. I think they got a problem at that point.
Hey, Robert, thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Take care, buddy.
All right, here's everybody's law school exam. Sit down, get your book out. We're going to write an answer. One question exam. Your whole semester depends on one question. Can two private consenting adults enter into a contract to change a statute? The Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. Our website, championsofthepeople.com. All of our free books are there. All of our podcasts are there. And you can get the information free. We'll be right back. That was taxes. Wake up. As I say in the military, listen up. We're legal rock and roll this morning, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Our telephone number, 303-713-8255, 713-8255. We're here for you. Join us live now is Eric from Caitlin's. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. How are you guys doing today?
All right.
Eric, I'll make you bet the deck's not open.
You know what? I'm not going to take that bet. We're not going to wing that one today. No, sir, that's not going to happen. But we do have a couple of specials I can run by. We're going to do the Huevos Rancheros. We're going to showcase that for our breakfast special today. Now, that is two corn tortillas with two eggs cooked any style on top of that. Golden brown hash browns, of course, scratch-made beans. You get your choice of that red or green chili that we make right here on premises. You can add carne adobada, which is the slow-roasted pork, or carne asada, which is the marinated beef. Add either one of those to your Huevos Rancheros plate. That's out of this world. That's the breakfast special all week. And our lunch special is going to be that tuna melt, one of our most favorite sandwiches we got around here. We're going to do that on griddled multigrain bread. That's going to be Swiss cheese, lettuce, tomato, fresh tuna salad. You can always add our homemade chips or our waffle cut fries to that on the side. Those are both really, really good to go with that meal. That's our lunch special all week. And, guys, don't forget, we are still doing every Monday and every Friday from 11 to 2, an all-you-can-eat taco burrito buffet. It is all you can eat. It actually includes a non-alcoholic beverage in the price of that buffet. You can't beat that. We do have crafts and mimosas, and we do have flat-screen TVs. We do not have the deck.
Your flat-screen TVs are going to have the Olympics on today, then?
We have Olympics. We have all kinds of sports on, absolutely. You can check out a little bit of football. You can, of course, check out the Olympics, everything going on. Tons of things to come and check out. Tons of scratch-made products to come and enjoy. Be careful on the roads, of course, out there, guys, in Colorado, but Caitlin's is worth the trip, so come on down and check us out.
Okay, Eric, where are you located?
We are 4379 East Mississippi Avenue. Now, guys, that is one block east of Colorado Boulevard, and that is the Glendale Shopping Center. It won't be a waste of your time to come and check us out.
All right, Eric, thanks.
Thanks, Eric. Take care, everybody.
All right, Caitlin's Restaurant. You'll love it every bite of the way. All right, so if you're going to buy a home, you're thinking about buying a house, right? You're going to buy a home. What are the top five mistakes you might make? Do you know what they are? Would you like to know what they are? Do you know how to avoid them? I mean, you don't want to make the mistakes. You want to know what you're doing. It's just like we say, we have a legal game plan. Barry and Larry, the Consumer Real Estate Show that follows our show, they're going to be talking about the top five mistakes buyers make and how you can avoid them. You want to listen to this show. Also, they've got a great boot camp seminar coming up on March 3rd, and they'll give you the information about that. But a boot camp seminar, right, for home buyers and sellers. Wow. Information. Wow. What a concept. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Gary Bell, Brad Pollock, we're here for you. Today, our show on KOA from 10 to 11, that's 8:50 a.m., is on concussions. Everything you wanted to know about concussions. Concussions are not just a structural damage. It's an infrastructure inside your brain. Do you know what dendrites are? Do you know what axons are? Do you know how it relates to a car crash and how you can recover for a concussion? Do you know what to do? Listen to our show today at 10 o'clock. We cover everything on concussions. And by the way, the insurance companies always defend concussion cases when they say something like, When you went to the emergency room, your Glasgow Coma Scale was a perfect 15. That means you don't have a concussion. And, by the way, you didn't make any complaints of all these symptoms at the scene of the accident. Of course, you didn't, because these symptoms onset over weeks and months. But that's what they say, that you learn in our show exactly what to do. Many people suffer concussions. And when they say to you, well, the medical literature says that most people recover from concussions and traumatic brain injuries and get over it. What about the percentage that don't? And so you need to know how to fight this. You need to what the elements are. And your attorney needs to understand the medicine. You know, Brad, we talked about concussions. And when you go to the emergency room, they say your MRI is negative. It didn't show anything positive. You didn't have a brain bleed. You didn't have anything positive on your CT scan. Therefore, they say, the insurance company say, you can't have a brain injury. You can't have a concussion. But it happens all the time.
Sure, it does. And, you know, these symptoms can take a long time to come on. And they don't mean that you didn't have the injury. It just means that your brain took a little bit of time to, or you, it took you a little bit of time to recognize the injuries that you experienced when you had the shaken brain, or when you had the blow to the brain. Or to your head. And so the bottom line is the first thing you have to do is recognize that you've had the injury, and that's going to take friends and people telling you a lot of times, because a lot of times you can't measure the change in your conduct. You can't measure the change in memory as much as your friends can. You can't measure the change in your personality as much as your friends can. Other times you can measure. You can start telling you these headaches keep coming on, or I keep having this blurred vision, or I keep having this sensitivity to light. I keep having this ringing in my ears, and you realize that that's not the way it used to be, and there's something going on.
We always preach the mechanism of injury, every case we ever do. So what's a mechanism of injury in a TBI, traumatic brain injury, or concussion situation? Well, it can be a blow to the head. We know that. So let's forget that. Let's set that aside for a second. When you have rapid acceleration or deceleration, which we talk about on the KOA show today, your brain is smashed forward, smashed backwards, compressed. The neurological elements and components of the brain, the axons, can be affected. The dendrites can be affected. And, by the way, what is the most common area of the brain that's injured in a car crash with rapid acceleration or deceleration? It is the frontal lobe and the left temporal lobe and the right temporal lobe. What do those functions of the brain, what do those areas of the brain control? Executive functions. How does that affect you? Well, because you have symptoms later about cognitive processing, misplacing things, memory issues, long-term, short-term, intermediate-term memory issues, change of personality, mood swings, upset, angry, different kind of person. Can't tell me how many people have been in our office with a husband and wife, maybe, or family, and the injured person denies, say, I don't really have those issues, and the family says, yes, you do, because we found out that the loved ones or the people close to the injured victims usually, almost always, can tell and ascertain these changes in the injured victim before the injured victim even realizes, I'm more angry, I'm depressed, I'm anxious, I have appetite problems, I'm a changed person. What changed all this? Listen to our show today, 10 to 11 o'clock, KOA, 850 a.m. We do a different legal subject each week. Today's subject is concussion, we're going to keep doing it. We've done several shows already, and so you can go there. You can go to our website and listen to all those shows if you want to. They're free, and don't forget about our books. And so I want to go back a little bit to the Electronic Communications Act. We've got this case in front of the United States Supreme Court. And Brad, you know the technical definitions in the act, but the act was passed because there was recognized that the Fourth Amendment protections weren't so delineated, so specific to apply to the digital world, and now we've got this monumental case being argued.
It stuns me to think that we are in a situation where we don't have a right to privacy about where we go, and it's very difficult to keep track of what the law says, and I get a little confused over it at times, I have to admit, because I know that a police officer can't, or last time I saw anyway, a police officer can't go put a tracking device on your car and keep track of where you're going to and from when the tracking device is on your car. But they can now go check out and find where you've been going when you've taken your phone with you. Where's the expectation of privacy end? It used to be a pretty simple concept of what's the expectation of privacy. What the law says now as far as an expectation of privacy, I think people need to try and figure out when they're using their phones or when they're carrying their phones with them or when they're doing different things. This is going to be a very interesting case that's going to come down as far as whether or not there is an expectation of privacy or whether there isn't. It was argued in November, I believe, of last year, so
right.
We can expect a decision coming out this term and to find out what's happening for all those out there. Once again, when you're doing your banking, did you realize that you're banking, that you don't have an expectation of privacy with regard to your bank records, as it applies to the government anyway? Those records can be obtained without a search warrant. And the difference is, we have to remember, sometimes the subpoena still has to be served to get the records. But the question is, do you have to get a warrant from a judge? Do you have to get approval from the judge in advance before you get these items to determine whether or not your constitutional rights are being violated? It's something you have to take a look at.
Well, and there is a case on that. It's United States versus Jones. They said that the Supreme Court ruled that the installation of a GPS tracking device on a suspect's car without a warrant violated the Fourth Amendment. You needed a warrant. So it's a little bit confusing area of the law. And then you superimpose on top of that the digital world, and it becomes even more confusing. But a couple of interesting points is that in the Stored Communication Act, there's a provision in there that says the provider, like the phone company or the bank, cannot be sued. You can maintain any legal action if they comply and they turn over your records here, there, and everywhere. So you need to understand that in the digital world, it changes the Constitution, but there seems to be contradicting cases.
Well, you draw the fine line. If they seize your phone, they need to get a warrant to look at the content of your phone. But at the same time, if they're using your phone to track you, because like I said, it pings off towers, and in essence, you're giving third parties the right to know where you're at, because you got to understand, every time you pick up your phone and use it, you're giving a third party the ability to know where you are at. And you know, we can talk about this after the break, Barry, because, you know, how many times do you get on your iPad and it says they would like to know your current location? Such and such would like to know your current location. And you pick and you punch yes, that's okay. Every time you get into your phone or your iPad or Google or anything, and you say, okay, Google, give me directions on how to get to point A or point B, well, it has to start with where you're at right now. So you're giving these entities the right to know where you're at right now.
Right. Well, right after the break, we're going to talk about when you compare the United States versus Miller case against the Jones case, it's absolutely fascinating. In one, they both deal with tracking the car and a very, very fine line. Go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. You can call us here at 303-713-8255. We're going to answer all of your questions. I will be glad to do it. We do it every week. We are your champions of the people. Good morning. Welcome. Here we go. Get your legal coffee and your legal bagel. We're going to talk law here, the Bell and Pollock Legal Show, the only show of its kind. 303-713-8255. We've got a couple of callers, but before we get to them, I just want to reiterate this fascinating area of the law. You know, Smith versus Maryland said that there was no Fourth Amendment violation when the police, without a warrant, had, at the request of the police, no warrant, the phone company installed a device to record all of the phone numbers that a robbery suspect called from his home. He was in his home. He didn't need a warrant. Then you got United States versus Jones that said the installation of a GPS tracking device without a warrant violated the Fourth Amendment. You needed a warrant. So you can't put the GPS tracking device on the car. That violates the Fourth Amendment. But you can record the phone numbers of a burglary suspect inside of his home. What a fascinating area of the law. Good morning, Paul. Paul's joining us now from Denver. What can we do for you?
Good morning. It's really frustrating because the law is really supposed to be readily accessible and understandable by the average person. It's not supposed to be designed, the original intent, it's not supposed to be designed to be complicated such that people are lawbreakers, by very virtue of their daily activity. And the kind of complications that you're talking about goes to that it's gotten way too complex to understand what's allowed and what's not allowed, whether it be by police or an individual. That being said, I just recently, just sometime this month, I think it was, read in some other state, and I know it wasn't Colorado, I believe it was a superior court in the state, ruled that the police can force you to open up your phone via a fingerprint, and this is all without a warrant.
Right.
But they cannot force you to enter in a security code. And so they made that distinction. And it was, pretty complex how they, the rationale that the judge order, came down on. How
right.
They described it all. I couldn't reiterate right now, but it was fascinating. I'm like tearing my brain out. Okay, fingerprint, they can force your finger there, or you potentially use an image of the fingerprint. I'm not sure how it works, the scanners on the phone versus a digital code. I don't know if you're familiar with that case, but I think it kind of ties in to this whole issue about access to privacy and Fourth Amendment.
Well, those are great comments, Paul, and I think Brad's going to give you his take in a second, but put it in a little bit more perspective. There were a whole string of cases when you arrest somebody, they're charged with a crime. Can you take a lock of their hair to test it? Finally, they decided, yes, that doesn't violate the Fifth Amendment, not the Fourth Amendment. And then there was similar cases. A suspect be ordered to turn over his DNA? And yes, that can be handled, but they said it violated the Fifth Amendment. So now, switch back to your comments, the digital fingerprints. So obviously a very fine line. Your take, Brad.
Well, it started out in a Virginia case in 2014, and it moved up to recently in February of last year, I believe it was. A judge in Los Angeles signed a search warrant that required a woman to use her fingerprints to unlock her iPhone to give information. The rundown of what the difference is between the security code and using the fingerprint, I got to be honest with you, I really can't figure out the difference. And I'll spend more time researching it, so you'll for sure hear what I have to say next week. But when I've looked at that just on the surface, and I haven't had to argue it or use it in any case that I've had or anything else, and I just haven't been able to figure out why it is that you can force them to use their fingerprint to unlock. Now, I do know that in one of the cases, it was a situation where the phone had been triggered, or they believed that the information on the phone would be destroyed within 48 hours when if they didn't get the phone open, and so they were using it to stop the destruction of evidence or information. But you are 100% right, Paul, when you said that the law is supposed to be a way that we all understand it well enough that we can obey it and we can follow it and we know what our protections and our rights are. And it's gotten really confusing when it's come to the electronic age.
Well, I look forward. I'll try and pull that information up and that case up and send it your way. But I look forward to your comments next week on it. Thank you.
Yeah, and I'll be giving them, I promise.
Hey, Paul, thank you very much for the call.
Give us a call next week, Paul. We can use it.
Appreciate it. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Here's another law school question for you, or a United States Supreme Court question. Okay, so I just covered the fact that they can get your DNA, or they take a lock of hair from you if you're a criminal perp, if you're accused, if you're suspected. Well, that's the Fifth Amendment. I don't want to turn over my lock of hair. I don't want to give my DNA because that may tend to incriminate me, and that's making me incriminate myself, and it violates the Fifth Amendment. So what's the difference between the Fifth Amendment and the Fourth Amendment? Right? The Fifth Amendment says you don't have to incriminate yourself. The Fourth Amendment says that you can't have an illegal search and seizure without a warrant. So you get a warrant? Fascinating area of the law. Joining us live right now is Alex from Colorado Springs. Good morning, Alex.
Good morning, gentlemen.
What's going on?
This morning on Fox and Friends, they had a reporter who was using two Android phones in Washington, D.C., neither were connected to the cell towers or to wireless connection.
Right.
And one was on airplane mode. And he took a tour of Washington, D.C., and came back and had the phones read before he lit up or attached to a wireless connection. And they could show everywhere he went, even though his phone was not connected directly to a cell tower or a wireless connection, down to a point where his car stopped and he got out of the car. It was date and time stamped to the second. So even though you've got your phone off and without a SIM card, Google is still tracking you for purposes of advertising.
Right.
And so that kind of detailed data, I can only imagine what kind of use that could be for any law enforcement or other agency.
So, yeah. And so then, great point. Great point. Then the question is, you don't know that, or you've done it, and the Google has tracked you. So the police go and ask for all your movements in the last 24 hours, 4 days, whatever they're going to ask for. And that's exactly what we're talking about. Search warrant or no search warrant. The Electronic Communication Act or not.
You're sharing if you knowingly are sharing where you're going with a third party, according to the Supreme Court right now, that's not protected. Period. Everybody's entitled to know it.
Hey, Alex, thanks for the call. We got to go up against the wall in time.
Talk to you next week, Alex.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you, everybody. The Bell and Pollock Legal Show. Go to our website, championsofthepeople.com. Today, 10 o'clock to 11 o'clock in the morning on KOA, our one-hour injury show. We're talking about concussions. Everything you wanted to know. How do you prove them? How do you recognize them? How do you get through? How do you prove them to the insurance company? What do you do? It's a war, but you can win the war. We win the war all the time. We prove traumatic brain injuries. We prove concussions. And if it's happened to you, we can help you. Bell and Pollock, champions of the people.